This is Infidel One. Offending Coyote Down. Offending Coyote Down.
Roger that.
Welcome to Trappin' Radio. We're proud, organic, free-range, wild fur farmers of North America.
Let me tell you a little story about how I was raised. Every day work, every day pray. Got family, friends, yeah, everybody sins. A winner never quits, and a quitter never wins. Help folks in need, don't fall for greed. A jealous man is weak, so think before you speak. If you love them, let them know. If you hate, let it go. Fast can be fun, but sometimes you need slow. God is all good, the devil is so real. So listen up, y'all, cause this is how I feel.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got none. Except for the good Lord up above. I answer to no one.
Now let's cover our sponsors. They do a lot to help support Trappin' Radio. So I'm asking you guys out there and gals to help support our sponsors as they keep Trappin' Radio on the air. First sponsors, Oki Cable and Trap Supply. Jeb's the owner of this. He's out of Oklahoma. Super guy. You'll not meet anybody nicer. It's somebody you're going to want to deal with. You can reach him at oktrapsupply.com. You can give Jeb a call at 918-429-4648. Not only does he do trap supply guys, he's a fur buyer, so if you're around the Oklahoma or surrounding states, give him a call with your fur. When you need stuff, give him a call and he'll get it out to you as soon as he can. Our second sponsor is F&T Fur Harvesters Trading Post. Everything you need for trapping, hunting with hounds, and predator calling. Guys, if you're into trapping fur, hunting fur, chasing fur with dogs, you're not going to be able to think of hardly anything that you can't get from F&T. You can reach them at fntpost.com. You can also give them a call at 989-727-8727. Whatever you want, F&T's got it. Blue Ridge Outdoor Supplies. Scott Payne is the owner of this business. He's in Elkton, Virginia. He also has a lure line, Mountain Rebel Lures and Baits. He's got a great coyote trapping video. He's also a fur buyer in Virginia. Anything that you're looking for and your trapping needs, give Scott a call and he'll get it right out to you. Wildlife Control Supplies, proven solutions for wildlife control, delivering value, expertise, and products to the wildlife individual. If you're an ADC business, control business, even fur trapping, you need to look at these guys' website. Top-notch company, have everything you would want, even the odd stuff that ADC guys are looking for. You can reach them at wildlifecontrolsupplies.com. You can give them a call at 877-684-7262. International number is 860-844-0101. If you're a wildlife control professional, you need to have Wildlife Control Supplies as one of your favorites on your computer or your phone, because when you come across something that you need specialized equipment, Alan will get it right out to you. Now let's go trapping.
See, I'm a flag flying, Bible toting son of a gun. Yeah, I'm hell on the heart, just a rebel on the run. Scared, don't know it. Fear, don't feel it. The truth is the light. Sometimes you gotta fight. Good beats bad, right beats wrong. I'm a barroom preacher and this is my song. I'm climbing for the top, representing for the country. I'm the people's champ, right out to dig. Shotgun toter, Republican voter, Hank Jr. supporter, let's protect our border. To hell with anyone who don't believe in the USA, cause this is what I say.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got...
Hello everybody, this is Clint Locklear. I'm up in the Herkimer, New York at the New York State Convention. This is the first year I've been up here, and it is Thursday morning, and before the show opens, I grabbed a victim, the meat man, and he looks a little nervous, and
I don't know. I mean, it's just me and you talking. There ain't no reason to be nervous. And the other 25 to 30,000 people who hear this, don't even think about them.
All right. Okay.
So once you introduce yourself and where you're from.
Well, I'm Don Powell from Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania.
Punxsutawney.
Punxsutawney, the home of the groundhog, weather capital of the world, February 2nd.
Do you go watch that?
Oh, yeah. It's a big festivity for the whole area, and people come from, you know, every state and a lot of different countries. It's a great time, and everybody should experience it at least once. So,
does it ever seem to ring true, whatever his shadow
is? Oh, yeah. The problem is that he talks, Punxsutawney Phil talks in groundhogese, and sometimes the handlers can't always interpret him correctly, so he's never wrong, but sometimes the handlers have been a little confused. But
that is awesome. Okay, so you're known as the Mink Man. I mean, that's kind of what... are you known that way because you decided to be known that way, or is that just kind of way it's worked out over the years?
Mink's my passion, and I guess not only did I love trapping them, but I also loved studying them. And actually, you know, you've been a big part of that, Clint. I've never told you this before, but with your Teachers of the Night videos, whenever I could see how the red fox and the beaver and the coyotes reacted to those sets, that really got me interested in doing the trail camera footage. And so I have all kinds of trail cameras, and part of my DVD set, the success of that's been not because of me, but because of the one I've captured on film. And a lot of things that I grew up learning how to do, I didn't really realize why things worked until I saw the animals doing it themselves. And then a lot of myths, such as stepping sticks, I found that with the mink having short legs, low bellies, and long necks, that whenever you have those stepping sticks, that they were stepping on the stick and stepping over the trap. So it's kind of come up with different ways to, you know.
Well, I've seen, that's one of the biggest things I try to, when I'm doing like a cat demo or instruction, because the classic thing is all, you know, you line the circle with rocks, or you know, you have the two big logs on the side. And when I started running those of course mine wasn't really trail cameras, but the video cameras with the night vision, the cats would walk on the logs, they'd walk on the rocks, they would do, and it would, in all those years, I'm like going, how many cats did I actually miss thinking I was blocking them down?
And that's when I found with the mink, you know, things that I was doing wrong, I look back and think, boy, what a difference that could have made, you know, from my youth until now. So,
what is, do you mind asking me if I ask you what kind of cameras? Is it a secret? Or
no, it's, I use Bushnell cameras, and then also the Reconyx. So a lot of the thing with the Reconyx is it, I believe, is activated by heat sensors or body motion or whatever, but it's amazing how big of a distance, you know, I captured the mink coming down from 200 yards up a stream, and it's nice to see how they start on one side, go along the edge, hop over the stream, get into the water, come back up, go around obstructions, investigate holes and root systems, and so those cameras were a big part of my success, I guess, with understanding them. The mink.
I didn't know that you had a video with that on there. I'd be buying that this weekend.
Yeah.
I mean, that's... When we were running the cameras we had, they were, at the time, state-of-the-art, using actual video cameras, and we used, like, the wildlife eye model, and we had to build all this stuff, and we had all this infrared sensors and lights, and we could never... I'm pretty sure we never got a mink... We'd see like the tip of their tail, and the tip of, we would see the otter where they would blow through, and you'd see the wake, and then you'd find out where they'd been there later.
Yeah.
But as far as seeing them, our cameras couldn't come on that quick. So I never got to do anything with the mink.
Yeah, I was lucky in setting up even culvert pipes, and seeing the mink coming down through the culvert, swimming, you know, floating down through with the current, you know, just thankful that I'd got that footage. Also with them going in around the corners of the pipes and coming back out, just really opened my eyes to a lot of things. People ask what I'm good at. Well, to be honest with you, I'm good at catching possums, but you know, I have so much possum footage that if anybody ever wants to do a possum video,
you know how to do it. Just have it cheap and have it as a joke.
Yeah, well, you know how it is with you know, trying to get that trail camera footage.
I can't imagine the time it took to do mink.
The thousands of hours, literally, and then till you figure checking those cameras just like a trap line every day. And last year, that was my entire year, you know, was checking videos, so trying to learn more stuff. But
what is something that just stands out? I mean, I know when I took instruction from Johnny Thorpe. Mm-hmm. And I was up there for like 4 days, and the first 3 days I did what I wanted to do: bobcats, coyotes, and otter. That's kind of my main thing. And on the last day, Johnny's like, "Well, what do you want to do?" And I'm like, "Well, I'm in New York mountains with Johnny Thorpe. I mean, it's got to be mink." He said, "Well, you don't trap mink." I said, "That's irrelevant." Yeah. And I said, "I want you to show me Johnny's way of catching mink." And the first thing he did with me is took me to one of those little brooks, I think is what he calls them.
Okay.
It's a creek at home, but up there he calls it something different.
Right.
And he said, "Well, where's the mink going to be?" And he for about the next 30 minutes, dressed me down on my lack of knowledge of mink, and then explained how they would go through the area and his sets. And it was so different than I thought it would be. Because you read those things from the 80s on, you just set the trap up next to the bridge abutment. You shave off the bank. And he's like, "Well, but they're only here in certain places."
Yeah. Well, the thing that I feel is that the general rule is that mink don't always do anything. So if you can keep that in mind, that helps you to start realizing that you have to set up all the tiers. And when I call it tiers, I talk about the dry trails up on the bank, then down at the water's edge, still along the bank or on the land, then in the water, shallow for the swimmers. You'll have them swimming in the top of the surface, you know, the top edge sets, and then also your bottom sets. So basically, if you go based upon what you're saying that Johnny taught you, they're all
He's
over.
He's more of a high bank setter. Not a trail setter, but a high bank setter.
Okay. Well, I like the trail setting with the what I call perfect steppers. Bob Best had taught me years ago. I traveled to Ohio and saw one of his demonstrations, and he taught me to use wide maple sticks or branches. So, you know, for years I was cutting maple branches that are in the form of a Y, putting those in the trails and having the animals centered right up on those trails, stepping perfectly on my pan. And then it got to the point where, you know, I was spending a lot of time looking for sticks, or they would turn and stuff, so we started making what we called perfect steppers, which again is just basically two prongs into the ground with a V, and it'll catch you everything from coyote, fox, you know, possums, and including
mink.
That
can't be true, because animals are scared of metal. Everybody knows that. If they're made out of metal, I'm just making that assumption.
Yeah, they are made out of metal. Yep.
Well, how can that be?
I don't know how you can say it, but I have a lot of footage showing that it is that way.
And they probably don't even pay attention to it.
They never even slow down. Nope. But, yeah, we call those perfect steppers. The other thing, you know, you ask, what else did I find? Well, one of the things that was interesting is I used to always just pin my bait back into a pocket or wire it up in the back of a route box for mink boxes. And I started seeing that the mink would work from the back or avoid some of my pockets, look in and just continue on. Well, a lot of the footage showed that they would look in and then come around from to the back, and I started wondering why. When other situations, they would, you know, go right in. And I started realizing, based upon where it hit me, was in a culvert situation. I had the piece of trout back in the culvert wired up, and a mink worked it, and the trout kind of switched positions. It was working it from the head position being downstream, and whenever it was pulling on it, the trout switched positions. Well, the next time that it came back, it went around to the top. I started realizing that every time I had the fish positioned in a certain way, that's the way the mink would come into it from. So
they would try to eat the back end or the head end?
They would come towards the head end. Yep. So I have a lot of evidence showing that, you know, really is a true thing to be concerned about or watch. So.
Well, that is cool.
Yeah, that's a really, it was an eye-opening thing. And I found that the way they worked my boxes and the success rate was a lot higher by pinning that bait so that the head was always facing out towards the trap direction. Just one of those little things that you wouldn't think much about. But
are you going to still run cameras this year?
Yep, still running them.
Maybe I need to see if you'll do me a favor then.
Okay.
Since I'm asking you in front of everybody.
Yeah, that's
if I get you some portable pockets, would you see how the mink reacted to that?
Yeah.
Because, have you looked at them over on Norm's table?
No.
I'm using them more for beaver, otter, and coyotes and cats than I am. I've caught muskrat with them. They're deadly on beaver, but it's just a pipe. And what you're telling me, I'm really curious now, just out of useless information I would like to know. It's open in the front. It's about an inch and a half pipe, but there is an opening on the back.
Okay.
And it's a stake, and the way that I'm using it, you don't have to use it this way, is I'm using it with a slider to take a beaver in the water. And that's my stake and the tractor and everything on it.
Okay.
And then the I'm just curious if they're going to work it from the back, because you're not really putting it in the ground,
mm-hmm.
per se. I'd just be curious of what a mink would. I'd love to see what they're actually doing with it.
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that.
I'll get some of those from Norm and give them to you.
Yeah. Now the second most famous animal in Punxsutawney is Ruth. Now, we have a captive mink that's on our videos, and what we've done with her is basically just studied her in an aquarium situation where I always thought that mink, you know, primarily the raccoon are using their front feet to pick things up and eat with, whereas the minx doesn't really use their front feet for anything that I can find, other than they're big on going down to the bottom of streams and turning over rocks, picking those rocks up, displacing the crayfish, and then going back and killing the crayfish. And Ruth, who her name is Ruthless Killer, she just will wipe out an aquarium of crayfish. She'll just continually hunt and hunt and hunt until they're all gone, and she'll try to do the same thing with the chubs and minnows. And so that was another thing I realized with the pockets, that they're oftentimes not hungry, they just have a desire to kill. And
well, you know, that's interesting. I'm glad I'm not the only guy that when Chattanooga's got an aquarium and they've got otters at the very top and they've got this whole system set up, and I would sit up there for hours,
mm-hmm.
watching them. And after a while, it was almost like the people working there were, you know, I'm actually taking notes, and they're like, you know, like that's like an otter pervert or something. But I learned how they, like, to me, like, some things I'm curious if, from your experience with the cameras, if an otter's going into the water, he doesn't step into the water, he kind of pushes out like a kid would on a float, so his feet don't actually go down.
Yep.
And then an otter going upstream, if there's any current at all, will drop to the bottom. But if he's coming downstream, he stays on top of the water. If the current's too strong, he'll go over,
mm-hmm.
the road instead of go. Is that, do you think mink pretty much do
pretty much the same thing? Yep. And the other thing that I find with it is they for set locations, they love, before they go in, they love to take a look under. So they'll take those big long necks and put their head in under the water and take a, you know, kind of scan things, scan the environment, and then go down in. But it's funny too how their butts float. You can learn a lot about trigger placement for your conibears and stuff by, you know, understanding that too.
It sounds to me like you really brought the, as there, now this happened to me when I come out with Teachers of the Night. There was a lot of people that had these beliefs in their head about something, and when they saw it different, they actually got aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was like you were challenging what they thought for 20 years. Did you have that with your mate?
I did, until they see the video, because how can you argue with the...
Oh, you know, people can argue.
Yeah, they can argue. But one of the big things on that was, I was taught, you know, and you're reading some method books, is to have your trap about a half an inch or an inch underwater for the swimmers. Well, when you see a mink swimming on the video, you can see that they're a good 2 to 3 inches is where those feet, you know, are going to be, at least 3 inches down. And they're doing that, I call it minky paddling, but it's like doggy paddling, where their feet are, you know, just going across those traps. So you have to have your pan a little higher too. With canines, you're always taught to keep that pan down below the jaws. But for mink, because again, they have that short, those short legs and low belly, they like to step up on things. So having that pan a little higher seems to be a benefit.
Well, see, I always thought when you were setting traps in water where something would be swimming like that, that you would expect them to hit the trap and then crawl up on it. But you're saying you're catching them as they're swimming.
Yes.
In a foothold trap.
Yeah, and where they're swimming, they're raking their feet across the pan. Now, there are sets that I call pier sets, because the mink, their fur has a lot of air in it, which I never realized either. The first time I saw my captive mink there, Ruth, swimming down in there, I thought, holy man, what's going on? There's all this bubbles coming out of its side of its, you know, fur. And I thought something was wrong, but here it's, you know, just their fur absorbs that air, or holds that air, I should say, and it helps them with their swimming. Well, the other thing that they do is they do that swimming, and then they'll get back up onto something and shake off, just like a dog would shake. You know, and that kind of rejuvenates that air in the fur. So those pier sets are so important because of that too. So, and that's where you'd basically put some sod or grass on your platform. They see that, and they see that as an opportunity to take a rest, or, you know, get back up and look around a little
bit. So that's like something you're putting on a really high bank situation, or a culvert, or...
Yeah, any place that you think a mink had been swimming and would either want to get up on that to take a look around, maybe put its neck in under the water. So you're just having an inch or so above the water where they can easily climb up on it.
Do you ever catch muskrats that way?
Oh, yeah, it's a real good muskrat set. And that's why the title of our DVDs are Mink After Mink on Purpose. That's why you know, a lot of the people that are catching mink are catching them by accident in their muskrat sets. But they're a completely different animal than a raccoon or a muskrat. So by understanding their habits, you can really increase your numbers in the same location. I can be trapping right along with a lot of good raccoon trappers, and they're not catching any raccoons, and, you know, I'm picking up the mink. So,
well, that's, you know, like from the otter point of view, I think it's a disservice when people, just how the human brain works. If you're in an area that has otter and a lot of beaver, and you're a beaver trapper, you're going to accidentally catch some otter. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of these states, especially when I get further north, they have limits. So they're only allowed 2, 3, 4, 5 otter anyway. So they catch those otter accidentally year after year after year, and they never set for them.
Okay.
And then the thought process seems to go, otter's really easy to catch. I'm not even trying to catch them when I'm catching them. So they don't respect what they, like a mink, you know, because I remember when I went to Michigan years ago, I've never been around mink populations like that.
Mm-hmm.
We was catching them in coon sets and muskrat sets, and I mean, it was cool to me, but I was like, well, these things ain't that much. You just got to have them, yeah. You know, really. And when it comes to like the otter, it's really easier to catch, you know, 6, 8, 10, 20 by accident. Go catch 100.
Right.
It's totally different what goes on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think I misspoke there saying about, you know, the guys trapping around me catching, not catching any coon. They're not, the coon trappers aren't catching any mink is what I was meaning to say there. So, yeah.
So, I'm going to pick your brain a little bit just because I've always been, my favorite thing the last couple of years has been catching mink in cages.
Okay.
Because it's simple. You know, it's something that it's easy for me to check, and it's easy because I'm not really mink trapping per se, but, you know, I find sign, I can put these little cages out. But if I was going to go to Foothills, because I used to raccoon trap the way that I did, I'm always thinking of water level. So after going to Johnny, it's always, now when I actually do set traps for mink, they're always on dry land. So what would you be looking for to set on dry land? I mean,
well,
because you're in the Appalachian Mountains too, right? So it's going to be pretty similar.
Well, Johnny would be up around the Adirondacks there, and I'm down around Pittsburgh is more my location. But we have just small streams, you know, some bigger streams. But as far as setting just on dry land, I'm always saying that a one-trick pony doesn't last very long at the circus. So it's the same thing with a mink trapper with the weather conditions and flooding and stuff like that. I'm looking at all the different tiers. You know, I'm not just thinking dry land because I call it the wind chill factor too, that it seems whenever people say about storms, but what really seems to make them hit that water is when the wind chill factor gets down, you know, very low. I think it's a lot warmer in the water, and that seems to drive them down there. So I wouldn't want to just have my dry trails up there then. Plus, then you're fighting the snow and stuff. So I'm trying to cover all those, the four tiers that I mentioned, you know.
You know I live in Tennessee, right? Okay. We don't have wind chill.
Yeah, you don't
snow,
have anything.
So.
I hear you.
So, I'm seeing in my mind what you're doing. I went up and visited a guy in Maine. It was either last year or the year before, and he had me interested in moving up there.
Okay.
And all the mink and otter and muskrats on these rice, I don't know what you call them. They're like coves coming off the ocean or swamps or whatever you'd want to call these great big things. But the tide would drop 7 and 8 feet a day.
Those coastal waters, yeah.
Yeah, and he was like, well, on the bottom you set a trap, and then you come up here and you set a trap, then you come up here and you set a trap, and I'm looking at him like he's lost his mind.
Yeah.
I'm like, you talking about shooting in the dark.
Right. Well, what I do whenever I get to a location, let's say we're pulling into a culvert location, the first thing I'll do is look and see, is there a crossover that's pretty obvious or
over the road.
Yeah, so it may not be obvious. It may be a very faint trail, but I look for the crossovers. Then I'll look for, on each side, is there a parallel trail that everything's using, from coon to fox and coyote to mink. So there I'll have my dry trails. Then I'll look for slips where the bank has fallen down. That's usually a good location for them to want to pull out. And then your pinch points, for any obstruction that would cause them to go around something. Points of interest, like a root system. And then, you know, in my culvert, you know, I have good blind sets there. And then is there a good place to put a baited set on each side? So, but the thing I'm doing is I feel like the three most important things, I'm in real estate, you know, so what are the three most important things in real estate are location, location, location. But with mink trapping, it's locations, 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 having a lot of locations to try to hit a big population, you know, not a big population, but a lot of lot of mink because there aren't big populations. So you got to get a lot of traps out over a lot of area. So the first day I'm going to go and I'm going to make the two quickest sets that I can make. Usually when I call quick tunnels, where basically you're just taking that suicide set, creating a point of interest by leaning like a railroad plate up against a bridge wall or a culvert, giving them a tunnel. Charlie Dobbin said, if you want to start or you want to catch a lot of animals, start with a hole. Well, I believe for mink, you start with a tunnel because they love to go through things. People say, well, why do they do that? It's like a dog chasing a stick. I don't know why they do it, but they do it. They can't hardly resist a tunnel. So I make those quick tunnels on the bridge walls, make two of them, move on to the next location. Try to get my whole line set up, at least those loops all set up with those types of sets. Then whenever I'm coming back through the next day, I won't do anything with those locations until I have my whole line set up. But then once that line's set up, then I'll start on each time I check it, which is, you know, in Pennsylvania we have to check every 24 hours. Then I'll go ahead and start adding other sets in. So I'm not setting eight traps at one location the first day.
So you're running a progressive line, but just not on different animals.
I never described it that way, but that is the perfect way to describe it. Progressive line. I'm going to copy that from you because that's the perfect way to describe it.
Yeah. See, I do that with different animals. Like if my target animal is otter, I set all the otter, then I go in and set the beaver, then the coon, and then. But every day I'm only thinking about that one animal.
Yeah.
Now, are you doing the tunnel set because it's fast and easy, or is that your most productive?
Well, it's a very productive set, and it is fast and easy. So it's something that I can gain a presence at a location. People, one of the things with me is, in our area, we have a lot of competition. But if I get to a bridge and there's somebody else set there, in most cases, I will just keep on going and get to the next one. Try not to do what I call hiving, where you know you have a bunch of trappers all at one location. I'd rather just try to claim locations, and then if other people come after me, that's fine, but I don't want to be known as a guy who's jumping in on somebody else's spot.
You'd have a rough time in Iowa.
Yeah.
You would have a rough. I mean, there's so many people under those bridges. You just hang around to launch the big barbecue.
Yeah, but see, that's why I'm working hard to be the first one there. So the first day, with my thought process, I'm flying. And if they can beat me there, they were probably there before season. So
in reality, though, most people aren't setting that many bridges.
No,
I mean they're probably very localized in what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it's a passion, and it's taught me a lot, you know, about getting up early, getting out there, and adjusting. People say about having patience when you're mink trapping. You have to have some patience, but to me, it's mostly diligence, you know, adjusting. So whenever I give this demo here tomorrow, you know, you're going to see all kinds of, you know, tools. And I say it's like building a house. You wouldn't want to try to build a house with just a saw and a hammer. You could do it, but it's nice to have some other things like a level and a square and stuff like that.
You've obviously never seen me, but it's a chainsaw and a screwdriver.
Well, you can get her done that way. But I like to have the right tools. So I have a lot of adjustable platforms that have legs that adjust and tables that instead of me messing around, I can just easily move them. Tables are basically just a platform for my trap along a bridge wall for those swimmers that can just be moved. And it's all about having a system, I believe.
So from looking at your table and reading your mink book, it seems, and I may be totally off base on this, but I'm making a judgment on you.
Okay.
You have these concepts, and then you get to, because no creek's the same, no bridge is the same, no culvert's the same. when you come across something that what you're doing doesn't exactly fit it perfectly, you start piddling, is what my wife called it, until you get the tool to fit that one thing, and you may or may not need that again.
Yeah.
Till somewhere way down the road.
Mm-hmm.
That's where all your tools and your...
Yep. Yeah, I know what their habits are. And so, like, what you're saying is I have one location where I could not get my plates to keep from being washed out, you know, with the high waters and stuff. But it was a great location. And so what I did was to basically took two plates and some fence posts, metal fence posts, and made them to the approximate depth of where I needed for the water. Then instead of having anything that's being washed out by the current, I can just wedge that in that culvert, and it, there's no resistance, no surface, you know, for anything but basically flat plates. So I can keep my traps working in there all year.
But are you trapping pretty much the same area every year?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, I have what I call reliable sets, and those are ones that have, you know, been catching mink for in that area for quite a while. And then I have speculation sets, which are every year I try to get rid of a few locations and add some other ones. So,
very rarely have I got to be in one place very long, just my nature of my business. So, if I'm gathering what you're saying, and I think this is awesome if it's what you're doing, a lot of the tools and the different ways you're setting, you're when you get out of a location, you've already been there, done that, you know how to make that exact location the best that it is, because you're designing
mm-hmm.
these different things off of the individual locations.
Yeah, and I'm big on analyzing. I'll look over my numbers and see, well, hey, this looks like a minky location, and there should be mink here, but I'm not really catching what I should be. So then I'll look at it and try to adjust for the next year. And, you know, with the flooding and stuff, every location changes. And I don't get as much time as I used to, you know, go out pre-season and do anything. But at least I have an idea and a tool, and most of my tools are capable of, you know, being adjusted to the situation and making it work, you know, without a lot of effort. So my effort came beforehand, you know. They say, how do they say that? The more you sweat and practice, the less you bleed in the game, or something like that. So
actually, that was over the CP when I was in the 502nd. The more you sweat and train, the less you bleed on the battlefield.
Yeah.
We looked at that every day when we were there.
Okay.
So
yeah. So that's the kind of thing with mink trapping. If I say you can catch a lot of mink in May and June and July, you know, by getting your tools ready and having them ready for whenever the trapping season actually comes in.
Well, just from a simplistic way of thinking of something you've already said, if the mink like the tunnel and they're on the side of the culverts or bridges, how come you just couldn't put a centered up 110 inside of a box?
Yeah, you can. Yeah.
You can.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and if you see the video, which I'd like for you to see, you'll see Ruth, she just loves those tunnels, and she would just go right through. And the thing that happens is they talk about trigger avoidance. Well, I use a lot of treadles or pans, you know, in my 110s too, because like we talked before, some of them will just take a peek in and then back out, but once they step on that treadle, you know, then it's all over. The other thing that I'll use as an analogy with the triggers is I have a little apple orchard that this time of the year in the fall, it's tough to mow around because the branches are heavy with apples and they're, you know, you're trying to mow in around. Well, you can take that mower right in it and move your head back and forth and still get through those low hanging branches just by maneuvering a little bit. Well, the mink is really good at that. It's not that they're afraid of that trigger. It's just that they're able to, you know, conform their body to go around things. I mean,
Ruth can turn around in a 4-inch pipe with no problem at all. She goes in, turns right around in the middle, and comes right back out. They're double jointed, or whatever you want to call. So it's not that they're that smart. It's just that they're made to avoid a lot of the things we as trappers, you know, put in front of them. So you have to adjust that
stuff. Well, if you think of a mink's size of his head, and then the actual diameter of a body grip trigger, that'd be like someone asking me or you to run our face in a half-inch piece of rebar. We're not going to do it.
Right.
You know, and one of the failed things that I've done that it may work for somebody somewhere else, we have extremely clear water where I'm at. I mean, it's like Caribbean bathtub water.
Okay.
Unless we're in a flood state. So, and the triggers have always bothered me inside of the trap. I've just, you know, there had to be a different way. Well, we were playing around with great big colony traps for beaver and otter. And, you know, and overanalyzing, well, if you had plexiglass for doors and it just looked like nothing was there, they would hit that before they could adjust and be in the trap.
Okay.
So then my brain went, why can't I do that into a body grip? So if he's going through something, he would hit the plexiglass before he realized that the plexiglass was there and it would fire the trap. In theory, it worked really well.
Mm-hmm.
Our water, because it flows so much, if you put something solid there, the silt comes around the back side and makes it look like a spray-painted panel of brown. So my clear door is only clear for like 10 minutes.
Okay.
So that didn't work. But I've never liked triggers inside of a body grip.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I did for otter, and I'm not sure because a mink is so small that it'd make that big a difference, I cut up a bunch of savages down in Louisiana one time, made them 20 inches long, and then instead of having triggers in it, I made a piece of pipe that would rotate on that one of those bottom jaws, and the dog could hook into it, and I run fence posts up both sides.
Okay.
So I had 20 inches of open, and then I took very, very tiny metal wire and put two across. And let me tell you, the otter didn't ever know what was going on when that happened. But it was aggravating because every catch, you had to rewire the trap.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that wasn't as easy as it sounded. So what do you do for trigger placement, or do you just went pretty much
all
treadles?
I like the, for the dry trails, I like the BMI bell triggers and or trip wires, you know, the belly wires. And you can also think about, you know, stabilizers, which we also sell Perfect Duckers, where basically they are able to be stabilized with the trigger on the bottom or the top. And every situation is different. I mean, depending on your grass and stuff, but grass grows up from the bottom, but there are banks where, you know, it's hanging down over. So that all is stuff that, you know, I look at. But yeah, for the boxes, I use the treadles, and they can be Barker mink pans or those Savo treadles that you get from Canada. The problem with them is, you know, the shipping's a little higher, but I have enough that, you know, that hasn't been a problem, you know, anymore.
And when most of those are set, though, that treadle's actually sticking up a little bit.
A little bit. You can adjust them just like with starting a trigger on a conibear, you know, your regular triggers starting so that it moves a little bit. You can do the same thing with those other, you know, treadles. So,
well, I've wondered why that hadn't become a lot more popular with raccoons in boxes.
Yeah, I don't know why.
It just makes better sense. They wouldn't be reaching in and doing all that.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you get into trapping? I'm always curious about this.
Well, I was about 9 years old and visiting my grandparents, and they had a little general store in Porter, Pennsylvania. You know, hardworking people. And he also sold to the farmers feed for the horses and stuff like that, along with the general, you know, store. And I was asking about trapping. I don't even know how I heard about it, but he said, there's a a trap down in the feed shed there. If you want it, you can have it. And I went down. It was a number one Victor. And boy, that was the start of it. Whenever I was just fascinated with that little number one Victor. And one of my brother's friends who was trapping muskrats, and he let me go with him and my brother. And we caught that first muskrat. And ever since then, I've been hooked. And I bought every book I could ever find, you know, and the videos and stuff now. I'm just hungry for it. But
Do you use big pans?
I do. And that, again, that is between you and O'Gorman.
That's where I got it from originally.
Really?
These old MJ600s in the 80s.
Yep. And I'm a big believer in that. Talk about things that people will argue with you about. But yeah, I think I call it step coverage, you know, and just the mink's foot's so little that if you can increase your landing pad for them, it makes a big difference. So
I can imagine. I mean, especially with the mink, and I've played around. I've caught mink in threes with the big pans with no on long springs,
mm-hmm.
and I even use those on muskrats. I mean, do you really need it for a muskrat? No, but I may catch an extra one I didn't.
Yep,
wasn't gonna catch before.
It's nice to have the odds in your favor.
Oh, absolutely. And are you a coal spring guy or a long spring guy, or do you use both?
Well, growing up, I used the long springs, and I used to use the number two Victors for my fox trapping until the, you know, coyotes came.
Old square jaws.
Yeah, the old square jaws. And so, unfortunately, I sold a lot of those and replaced them with 1.5s at the time and stuff, but still had some. And actually, that was my best Christmas. I got the 3 number two Victors and a BB gun one time, and man, I was on top of the world, you know. But anyways, I started using the long springs, then switched to the 1.5 coil springs, and then read somewhere where somebody said about number two Victors, and I still had a bunch left, and that now is my favorite trap, you know. So I don't even look for new traps. I look for used number twos that I can modify by putting a swivel in the end and having the bigger pans, and that's all I need for mink. It gives a good high hold. Guys have said about fur damage. I don't think I've ever had any fur damage from the, you know, the trap itself. So
well, the old square jaw Victors are my favorite traps to set on logs.
Uh-huh.
Because they're flat, and
yep.
I've got a panda dog fetish, and they have the best leverage system that's ever been made on that trap. Mm. But it's crazy. They're expensive now.
Yeah, they're going up. Yeah,
And you're like going, wow.
I think a lot of mink trappers are, you know, bringing them back to life. So,
I see on your thing you're using a lot of the body grips on your table. Just when I looked it over, mm-hmm. You're using. Do you ever try colony traps or funnel traps or?
No, in Pennsylvania we're not allowed to use those, so I've never tried them even.
Mm. Well, you got to go to somewhere that's not a communist state, man.
Yeah. Oh, I like Pennsylvania. We have our problems, but.
And have you ever went out of state, or you pretty much stayed at home?
I've traveled, like, just to look at other areas. I went up through whenever, even the last convention that was in Minnesota, I took an extra couple of days and went down through, like, Iowa and those areas, looked at where Bud Hall used to trap, you know, just, I don't know if it was the exact bridges, but I went to a lot of his areas and looked at those bridges to try to understand, you know, what they were facing. And
well, one of the, and I wish I could find the picture, and it was in an old, I don't know if it's in an old book or it's an old magazine, but Bud Hall has always been an interesting guy, mm-hmm. you know, and so was Griggs when mm-hmm. it come to the mink. And one of the pictures that I found that once I was getting hammered on these big pans so bad,
mm-hmm.
I came across this old picture, and I wish I'd have took a picture with it on my phone, because it might have been at Tom Parr's Trapping Museum. He had Griggs, you know, and he's showing all these mink. And you see the traps he talks about in his book. But in the very back of that corner of that photograph, kind of like wasn't supposed to be in the picture, were number three Blake and Lambs with soup pans that were wired, bolted, or something on that on inside, and they were almost to the jaws.
Okay.
You know, and yeah. I was like, yes!
Yeah, he was, yeah.
But he didn't talk about it.
Uh-huh.
That was one of the, you know, back in those days, you didn't tell people yep. what you really did. You yep. just kind of gave them enough information to sell the book.
Yeah. Well, a lot of these guys have really helped me. I mean, guys like Russ Carman and, you know, all these guys that had wrote books and stuff, you know, I consider them mentors to me. And they've made such a difference in my life by getting me interested in trapping. Like I said, I think from even a business standpoint, you know, just dealing with people and also, you know, adjusting and planning and stuff like that. It's I owe a lot to those people that came before me. And I'd like to try to dig the well a little deeper so that anybody else that's thirsty to get some knowledge, you know, I'd like for it to be there. That's minktrapping.com. Was you know, designed for that too. Just basically anybody, it's a free site, and anybody that wants to, you know, talk about mink trapping is welcome to sign up. And
is it like a form or
yeah, I have all kinds of different stuff on there, but the value in the whole site is the forum, you know, because you have guys from all over that are sharing ideas from Oregon to, you know, Maine, and guys like Frenchie in New York, and just a lot of good trappers, and a lot of guys just getting into it, kids and people that retired and trapped as a kid and were coming back. You know, it's just amazing how much as a collective group you can advance the whole group, I guess, by sharing information. So, and that's, again, like I said, I'll go back to what you've done with your Teachers of the Night. That has made all the difference in my trapping, from coyote to fox and stuff. You know, I can just sit there, like you're saying about looking at the otter tank. I watch those tapes over and over again, those DVDs. And, you know, the great teachers are the animals themselves.
So. Absolutely. I'm still stuck on, with all this mink knowledge you've got, and you've never taken a stab at Iowa or somewhere where they got a lot of mink.
Well, I think about it. I do. You know, I think I'd like to see what I could do, you know, numbers-wise with different locations, but
If you get on, and I know you'd enjoy this, there's every year I interview a guy, Ryan Schaefer from Louisiana, and his big thing is mink.
Okay.
And the first, you'd have to go back even to the old original Trapping Radio, and now it's the Trapping Radio 2, but the original Trapping Radio's got his first one, and he caught a decent amount of mink. And then he went and he got all these DVDs, and he didn't catch any mink.
Yeah.
And then he went back to just taking a BMI out of the box, not doing nothing with it, stuck it in the trail, and he caught like 40 mink.
Yeah.
And then last year he got 212 mink out of like 38 traps.
Wow.
And it was, his was trail setting in Louisiana, and he was like, I read these books and the bait, well, they were hungry in Louisiana.
Yeah.
You know, I'm catching them at crawfish ponds, for goodness sake.
Yep.
And it was just, I think you'd find it fast, because he goes through the whole, on those three interviews, you go through a span of several years of highs and lows, and for one, he's just entertaining, but
yeah,
being a Cajun, but.
Well, you bring up a good point there with them not being hungry. You know, my captive mink there, Ruth, she couldn't starve to death if she wanted. She can kill anything, you know. And a mink out in the wild, you know, if there's any type of fish or frogs or anything there, I mean, they're fierce hunters,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so the thing that I think guys make a mistake with is trying to appeal to their hunger. I think what you have to do is you have to appeal to their desire to kill. And I think that's, again, where the eyes and having that bait faced out as if it's still alive, excuse me, might be more of the answer.
Do you think a mink would know the difference between a very well made artificial fish where they look just like a fish, and if you put fish oil on it, what do you think they'd know the difference?
Well, my baited bottom sets, you know, I started out using bluegills with them, and they didn't last very long, so I started experimenting with like Storm or Yum or power baits and stuff on the triggers, and underwater that seems to work very well. But what I found with that is the eyes are important. You know, you can buy some cheap ones. I tried to save money and buy some artificial baits that didn't have good eyes or good color, and I noticed a big difference that, you know, they didn't work very good. Even like Mr. Twisters didn't work. Even though you had that tail motion, you didn't have the eyes. So I'm a big believer in the eyes. As far as on the dry sets or in pockets, I think that you could probably get away with that smell and stuff, but I think it's, you can't hardly beat the, you know, the real thing with, you know. So I do a lot of salting, you know, bait collecting and salting them. And
so that doesn't, you don't think the extra salt hurts anything?
I haven't noticed that it did. And I'm using mostly using that whenever it's cold and freezing. So, you know, I'll use, might start out with some fresh trout that I just had frozen. And then as I'm catching muskrats, I'll use muskrat and stuff. And then whenever it gets cold, I'll use the salted fish.
Did you ever try on your cheaper baits just to get the defective eyes from the taxidermy?
No, I never tried that. Because
that would be, I would say it would be pretty spectacular, especially underwater.
Now, with in my cubbies or my mink boxes, I do use from the craft store place, Hobby Lobby. You can buy those eyes, like frog eyes and stuff like that, and I'll take a piece of wool, sheep's wool, and just punch those eyes through. They have little backs that you can squeeze together. I'll just put one in there and let it spin around, and that seems to work. And there again, that comes from guys talking about bobcat trapping, you know, using those eyes. I think Tom Krause might have been the one that I saw it from. So, but really now with the real baits, I've found that it's not, I haven't been spending as much time doing that, you know.
Well, to finish up, what are you looking for with a body of water that if someone didn't know that much about mink, where were the places they should key in on?
Well, with a pond, in our area we have some ponds, farm ponds and things like that, I'd look at the inlets, the outlets, and then I'd look for any type of structure, you know, points of interest, anything that stands out to you, you could look at. But if you're looking at a stream, just again, look at what you can get to fairly easily. If you're going to run a lot of traps, you got to be able to get to them fast. You can't walk 2 miles, you know, at each location and then expect to catch a lot of mink. Not everybody wants to catch a lot of mink. Maybe guys want to walk and just catch a couple, but for me, I'm looking at something pretty convenient. And then I have a belief that that mink's going to come through there, so I'll make a set. And with the quick tunnels, as an example, I make that a destination for them. When they see that grass-covered tunnel, you know, it could be under a bridge wall that has no other features. And people say, well, they hug. Well, they hug some, but they don't hug all the time. I mean, those tracks will show you, and videos will show you, they'll run right down through the middle of those things. And so the suicide set, which is basically just tied up against a bridge wall on a corner or something, that'll catch you some mink. But boy, if you make that into a tunnel right there, then that mink on the other side sees that point of destination, and it, you know, becomes a point of interest and a destination for them, and then your numbers start to really increase. So,
well, one thing, like you're talking about bridges, I mean, or culverts, that's a lot smaller animal. But one of the things I do a lot with otter and beaver if especially doing control, if it's somewhere that I'm like at home, I've got several of these set up, I will run a fence panel across the creek and only give them two ways to get up down the creek.
Mm-hmm.
If they go all over the place inside of that culvert, it seemed like you could make them go to the edge where it was very obvious.
Yep. Yeah, I call it nudging, just by doing like you're saying, you can fence things off, or you can easily just make it where they want to go there themselves. I learned growing up, my granddad had a little farm, like as a hobby farmer, and the cows would get out, or the cows would have to be moved, and it'd be my job to try to move them, like as a herder, and I found that you can't make the animals do stuff that they don't want to do a lot of times.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a lot easier to nudge them and get them to want to do it themselves. So that's the same thing with mink trapping.
I've learned that when my chickens get out.
Yeah.
You can't corral a chicken.
Yeah. So it helps with marriage too, and kids, raising kids too.
Yeah, yeah. Well, man, I appreciate it. That was a lot of information. That was really good. Now, see, that wasn't bad.
Got me out here in the middle of nowhere. What could I do? I had to tell you when I know. So,
well, I do appreciate it. I really do.
Thanks a lot, Clint. Thank you, everybody.